Welcome to the end of week 5. A third of the first term is over, the third of the first semester. I have just noticed that the little gadget that's supposed to record my slides and audio doesn't seem to have been switched on. So I'm not quite sure how long it's going to take until the video will be available. I am recording the video also on my MacBook, so I'll try to upload this as soon as possible. The audio will be uploaded today, but the video may be a little bit later than normal this time. But I mean, if you combine the video, no, sorry, the audio of the of what I'm going to upload and the the PDF, then that should be fine as well. Okay. Few announcements. I know you want to hear more about the exam. Okay? So, the exam is going to take place on the 26th of March in the morning. We decided to do this fairly late again, like last year, because that gives you an opportunity to, well, let things sink in to practice, etc. In the first year that I was here in Trier, we did it in the week or 2 weeks after the end of semester, and people told me that there wasn't enough time. Okay. You will be evaluated or assessed both on language and on content. Okay. The content mark is the more important one. It will be weighted at 60%, while language is only at 40%. If you fail language, I don't like to talk about failing too much, okay? But these questions will come up anyway, so I'll tell you about it. If you fail language overall, meaning if you have an average of less than 4 in the 3 parts, in the 3 exams, then this means that no matter how good you were in terms of content, you will fail the whole exam. Okay? Language is a knockout factor. If you fail a content part of an exam, if you, let's say, get a 5 in linguistics, which I don't hope is the case, but if you do, and you write a brilliant essay, which you have memorized, and doesn't really have all that much to do with the topic, you don't get a 1 for the essay, but you only get a maximum of a 4 as a grade there. Okay? To make sure that it's a fair way of looking at a combination of both content and language. Okay? I will upload the exact format, like the sample cover page and everything, to StudIP so that you can familiarize yourself with the format. We haven't got that completely ready yet. This is going to happen over the next few weeks. I can already tell you that it will consist in linguistics and also in the 2 other parts, if you're taking them, of 2 parts. The first one will be a range of 5 or 6 short questions, which will not require much writing. Okay, they may in fact sometimes be of the type that you just need to write a single word. Okay, the second part will then be a short essay. 100 to 150 words is not much. Okay, it's not even a full page. A4 page in handwriting. Okay. We say 100, 250 words, or in fact it may only say 100, but please do me one favor, do not waste time counting. Okay. Every time in the exams I see people, oh no, it's only 97, I need to find 3 more words. Okay. And then sort of trying to, can I get rid of this? And yeah, if I make it into this, progressive? Don't. Okay. I have a lot better things to do than counting your words. Okay? If you write 45 words, then yes, it's not enough. If you write 300 words, that's also not good. Okay, but I don't know. Practice at home. Write a paragraph. Count the words, and then if you have sort of a 100, 120, 130 words, fine. Okay, it should be at least around 100 words because we need to be able to look at your language. If you only write 40 words and you have all the content required in the essay, then that's still not good because we need a sufficient number of words to evaluate your language. Okay. I am going to provide a sample past exam. In fact, the Fachschaft is also collecting them. They're probably circulating them as well. You're very welcome to look at past exams so that you know what's ahead of you. Okay. And there will be opportunities for you to ask questions about those past exams as well. You need to sign up for the exams. The sign-up period usually stops 4 weeks before the exam. Okay. I can't tell you in detail how to do this because I don't see the same thing on LSF as you see. You need to find that out yourself, and it's usually no problem. We don't get any comments from students, I couldn't sign up for this or that exam. Okay. But if anything is not clear, make sure you don't try to do this exactly 4 weeks before the end of the before the exam. Okay. We will remind you again, it's now open, you can sign up for the exam, please don't forget to do this. Okay. Now, you will hear from other students in the second year or the third year that you don't need to do the exam on the 26th of March. That is true. You can postpone it. I would very, very strongly advise against it. Okay? It's your choice. I don't like it in a way that you have this choice because I think it invites things that are not good. Okay? In half a year's time, you will have another exam to write. You will then either have to do two exams at the same time or postpone that one as well. And then it just goes on and on and on. Okay. Also, if you were to fail, then the whole thing becomes even more prolonged. Okay. I hope you're not going to. Okay. But in the past, this exam has had relatively high rates people who had to do it at least two times. Okay, so not because we want to get rid of you, I think I've said that before, because people find it quite difficult to do this exam. Okay, I'm trying to help you by giving you extra exercises, and the tutorials, of course, are there for you as well. Anyway, we've talked about that before. So, think twice before you postpone the exam. I really wouldn't do it. Okay, any questions about the exam? No. Okay. Oh, yes, there is a question.
The topics you said we have, we get to choose for the essay.
Yes.
Are they chosen completely random? Or is like an essay either on phonetics and phonology, yeah, or morphology?
Yeah, in the exam, I will try to cover as much of the lecture as possible. Okay. Now, obviously, I can't cover everything, but I will try to cover as much of the sort of core things that I'm saying in the lecture. And in, let's say, the 5 or 6 short questions at the beginning, I may be able to do, I don't know, phonetics, morphology, syntax, or pragmatics. And then I'll try to do one that isn't covered in the 4 questions or the 5 questions in the essay. And you will get 2 essay questions that you can choose from, and they will be from 2 different fields. Okay? Good. I've just uploaded... Oh, there's another question. Yeah. Okay.
This exam, does it only cover this lecture or the other 2 as well?
You will actually have an exam which covers all 3 lectures, This is 1.5 hour exam, and you will get 30 minutes per exam, per lecture, basically. So you do all three at the same time. You can also not opt to do, let's say, only linguistics and TESOL now and literature a second time, sort of half a year later. Okay. The exams are only done once every half a year. Okay. So that's another reason why I say make sure that you do it now, because the next opportunity will only be in half a year, and then again in half a year's time. Okay? Any further questions? No. Good. I've uploaded the know list for phonetics and phonology to StudIP so that you can see which terms are particularly important. I've now also finally, and apologies for the delay there, I've finally uploaded an updated schedule that includes pages for the more recent edition of Finnegan. Okay. You'll find both of these in the general documents folder. Okay? Good. There's one correction I would like to make, because I said something which isn't entirely true, or I said it in such a way that it may have caused some confusion. I did say in lecture 3 that this here, the voiceless palatal fricative, is not part of English, or is not part of the sound system of English. Okay? This is, strictly speaking, not true, okay, in a way. It does exist. People, although British people cannot usually say München, they do it all the time when they say the words, for example, huge or pure. Okay? Which is, if you do a narrow phonetic transcription, the voiceless palatal fricative followed by the vowel. Okay. But the point is, it doesn't create any phonemic contrast. It's not part of the phoneme system of English. Okay. It does not create a minimal pair. There are no two words like pure and pure. Well, I can't even do it because it's sort of part of that word. Okay. All right? So that's a clarification or an addition or a correction from lecture 3. And in fact, Finnegan, I think, makes that point as well. Good, let's move on to morphology. Words. Not just words, but also parts of words. But we'll start with words. And the question of what is a word is actually something that we already quickly discussed in week 1, when I gave you the Humpty Dumpty nursery rhyme. Okay. And we could now, after the few weeks that we've worked together, perhaps come up with a little bit of a more sophisticated definition. We could, for example, say, isn't a word a phoneme or a set of phonemes bounded by pauses? Well, that would be problematic. If you were to produce this in connected speech, then you wouldn't actually produce any differences. Okay? The two of them would be a notion. Okay, perhaps with stress or there are sort of, I'm sure a phonetician would find differences there. Okay? But you see that this is not actually, there are no pauses involved. Okay? It's not the case that the white space between words corresponds to pauses. And we've already seen this. We saw this last week when we saw that connected speech produced interesting things. Okay, and that, words in a way affect each other. Okay. The endings of words affecting the beginnings of the following words, etc. Okay. So, this certainly is not a definition of a word. I'd like you to just have a quick look at this sentence. And we're not going to do this in any great detail. How many words do you find? From lecture 1, you know that the correct answer is? It depends. Okay? So, have a quick think for 15 seconds. Okay? It depends on how you count, and I'd like to quickly go through the different ways that we could apply in counting this. We could take a definition which is very mechanistic, very sort of something that a computer would like. A string of uninterrupted non-punctuation characters with white space or punctuation at each end. Okay? If we did this, then we would define it in an orthographic way. Okay? So we could call this an orthographic word. Okay? And particularly if you tell the computer to count, then this will be a very reliable way of counting. But we'll have to see whether this is actually always the best one or whether there might be other ways that make more sense in certain contexts. First of all, I'd like to question whether this orthographic definition is actually a natural division, whether this is something that we have all ingrained. And I've got a little letter from the daughter of a former colleague of mine in Lancaster that I would like to show you. Okay, to Mum and Dad, I like you and I love you, love from Emily. Yes, yes, sweet. Okay, but the point is, she quite clearly hasn't got the concept of word built into her brain. Okay, she has learned letters to some extent, not all of them are fine, but anyway. But it's not as if every word is separated by a white space. So the orthographic definition doesn't seem to be something that's natural as such. Okay. We already saw in the Humpty Dumpty example that the orthographic word definition is also problematic as soon as we have things like this, haircuts or ife. Okay. Is this now one word or is it two words? In a way, we can see that this refers to one thing, one action. Perhaps it makes sense to call it a word, but here we've got a contraction which links orthographically two words which are clearly very different. And so maybe we wouldn't want to call this as one word. It's easiest to it's easiest for counting with a computer, but there are limitations from a linguistic point of view. Okay. So what else could we do? Well, we could, for example, count like this. We count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay. In other words, we only count cook once. Okay. It's actually not. I'm just thinking. Yes, we do. Sorry. Yeah. I was confused for a moment. We have cook and we have cooks. We would still count this as two different ones because it's two different word forms, but we would only count this once, even though it occurs twice. If we do this, we make a distinction between types and tokens. This is a type. The word cook is a type, but it occurs twice. Okay? And if you count the number of different types in a text, or the number of tokens, is quite different. Now, this is a very short text. It's only one sentence. But if you imagine you've got a long text of 2,000 words, then many of the words will be repeated. Words like and the, and whatever. While other words will only occur once. If it is an academic text, then you will have a lot of variety, perhaps. If it is a spoken text, then many of the words that you utter will be repeated. Okay, so we have type and token. We could also say we want to count meanings or units of meanings. Okay. Let's have a look at this. The plane landed. How many units of meaning? Well, is the a unit of meaning? Okay, let's say it's got a meaning, it's a determiner, plane and landed. So three words. Okay?
I didn't quite catch. What's the difference between type and token?
The difference between type and token. Okay. Do we agree that we have twice the same thing here. If we have cook twice. Yeah? If I tell you to count the words, he could go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Okay? Or I could go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Ah, it's the same one, so I won't count it. 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. It's two different ways of counting, yes. Yeah. One counts the different forms, and the same form may occur twice, 10 times, 500 times. If you have a text of 1,000 words, you are likely to find about 60 instances of the. You would only count them once. Yeah?
And the 60 this is one
type. Is one type. It are 60 instances of the same type. Yeah, 60 tokens. Okay?
Okay.
All right? Okay, good. Okay. All right. Okay. Here we have three words. With the plane took off, I think you can see that this is slightly more problematic. Take off is somehow a unit of meaning. Okay. And many of you will know the idiom, he kicked the bucket. Okay? Now this could be a literal kicking, but he kicked the bucket also means he died. Okay? So to kick the bucket is one unit. So is it two words? Okay. You can see that depending on how you count and depending on what your perspective is, you might get rather different results. Okay. Now we've already seen the difference between type and token. I'd like to introduce something else which is related to that. Okay? And in fact, it's also related to the distinction between phoneme and foe. It's even more related to that. I'd like to introduce the concept of lexeme versus word form. Okay? If you again ask yourself how many different words we have, or how many different not separate words. How many different words that you would find in a dictionary? Mm-hmm. Then you would perhaps agree with me that we now, for example, do no longer have two instances of cook and cooks, but that they are really the same word. It's just that once it's in the singular and once it's in the plural, but it's the same word. Mm-hmm. And that would then mean that we now only have 9 words. Because cook, the type cook, the lemma or the lexeme, lemma and lexeme are sometimes used interchangeably, the lexeme type cook has 3 tokens. The 3 tokens don't look alike, okay, but they are all realizations of the same lexeme. Okay. Now, if you think back to phone and phoneme, the phonemes don't look alike, they don't sound alike, in fact, but they are realizations of the same phoneme. Here we have words that partly look alike, but also don't look alike, but they are realizations of the same lexeme. Okay? I'll introduce another one of those realizations versus sort of more abstract concepts in a few minutes when we do morphology. Okay. So, the lexeme is something abstract. Yes?
If we had to go from two cook and serve,
to what?
If we had to go from two cook,
yeah?
Would that be a separate lexeme or would we count it as cook?
Yeah, it's a good question because it's a different word class, right? You have, on the one hand, you've got the verb to cook, and you've got the noun, the cook. Okay. Now, again, it really depends on what you want to do with that situation. One way to answer that would be to say that they, some people make a distinction between lemma or lexeme and head word. This is complicating things a bit more. You could say that the lexeme or the lemma is the combination of head word and word class. Yeah? So in that sense, it would be the same head word, but it would not be the same lexeme. But the important question at the moment, or important point at the moment, is that you realize that we have one abstract concept. You don't see the lexeme. You only see realizations of the lexeme. You don't hear the phoneme. The phoneme is something in your mind, but you hear realizations of the phoneme. Okay? So it's the word form that realizes it. So the word class question is a good question, but it complicates matters at the moment. So, okay, good. Do you understand why I say it's something abstract? It's something that we don't quite... Well, everything we see is only a realization of the lexeme. Okay? That's why when I had the list, I wrote them all in capital letters. This is to say that this is the concept. Okay? Lexemes are typically written all in capital letters, as a convention. Okay. The final one, the final way of counting... it's really a very minor one, but I want to just mention it for completion's sake. You could, of course, also try to distinguish between those four words. What's the issue here? It's the same lexeme. It's different word forms. It's the lexeme what, but... they have different grammatical functions. Okay. Oh, no, wait a minute. No. Sorry. Gosh, it's been a very long week. I have to apologize. I'll scratch the last 20 seconds. Okay. I have 6.5 hours of exams, of oral exams in a row this week, and this has just gone right up into my mind. Anyway. The point that I wanted to make with this slide... okay, is that we have the lexeme walk, and you can see how this lexeme can be realized with four different word forms. Okay? It's all the same word in an abstract sense, but the realizations are different. Okay? Now, the next slide is the one that I gave you the text already of. Look at this one. If you look at the word red in those two examples, then you can see that it's the same word, it's the same word form, it's the same lexeme. They sound the same. But yet there is something different. Still there is something different. Okay? What's different? The grammatical function. Now this... could be called a grammatical word. This is an absolutely minor distinction now, and I just wanted to mention it for completion's sake. Okay. The important bit you need to get, that you need to take home, is the distinction between lexeme and word form. Okay, let's move on a little. We know from experience you're learning a foreign language, perhaps you're learning other languages as well, that there are differences with respect to how much grammatical information is part of the words. Okay? In English, we say we think. And if we look at the word, or the words rather, we think, then we find out more about what is referred to, or rather who is referred to, by looking at the personal pronoun we. We know that there are more, well, there's more than one person involved. Okay. If we compare this with other languages, then they do it differently. Not all languages do it differently, but some. In Spanish, you would say pensamos. In Italian, pensiamo. In German, you would do it very similar to English. We have two words. And in French, it's nous. And my French is very rusty, okay? Anyway. And the same information that is contained in we is actually contained in different parts. Okay. In German, we also have the pronoun we, but we also have a marker, an inflection, okay, which tells us that this is plural. While in English, there is no such marker. The same is true for French. And in fact, in Spanish and in Italian, they don't need a pronoun at all. This means that there are parts of words, potentially, not in all languages and not in all cases, which carry a particular meaning, a particular grammatical meaning. Now, the word think carries meaning. It means something. It means the action of using our brains to do something. Okay? But, of course, there is more, potentially. Who thinks? Is it now? Is it completed? Etc., etc. Now, in some cases, as we see here, this information is actually part of the word. When we talk about the individual parts of words, we are then talking about morphology. Before I go into detail there, I'd like to have a quick rundown of the word classes. Okay. I'd like to talk about the standard way of categorizing words. One useful distinction to make is that between open and closed class words. Open class words, or open class word classes, okay, are word classes which invite or which grow or which can grow. If a new word is formed in whatever way, it'll usually be added to an open word class. It's a content. These are typically called content words as well, or lexical words. Okay. Versus closed or grammatical or functional words. Let's have a look at them. These are the parts of speech, the word classes. The open ones are nouns, verbs, adjectives, and adverbs, although some people disagree about the status of at least some adverbs. So things like book, year, achievement, etc. Then lexical verbs, full verbs like make or look or listen or write or whatever. Strong, ultimate, accurate, etc. Adjectives, and then adverbs like so or very or happily or whatever, certainly, etc. These are examples of open class words. In the closed classes, we find determiners, prepositions, pronouns, conjunctions, and some verbs, namely the auxiliary verbs. Okay? So, modals like would, could, can, might, etc., etc. These are the more grammatical words. These are the functional words. Now, in fact, this is much more idealistic than reality. These are sort of fuzzy-edged categories. In some cases, actually, it's not quite clear whether it's an adjective or a verb. And in fact, whether adverbs are always closed class or not is also not quite clear. But this is the introductory lecture, so we don't need to worry about that now. You can start worrying about things like that in the third semester or in the fifth semester. Just very briefly, because we had verbs in two, in both categories, we have to distinguish between several types of verbs, lexical verbs that I already introduced, but then there are also the primary verbs be, do, and have. Okay. I have two children. Okay. So the have is different from I have seen the light. Okay. They're helping another word. A verb, okay? So then they're auxiliaries when they're not primary verbs, okay? So we need to distinguish between primary verbs and auxiliary verbs in addition to the lexical verbs. Okay. We could also look at what they do in terms of how specific they are, for example. And we would see that the meaning of open class words tends to be more specific, closed class less specific. I already said what is the meaning of the. Well, it's not really very specific as such. It specifies, but the meaning of it, the word itself. Frequency, Open class words tend to be less frequent than closed class. I already said that the is the most frequent word in the language, I think, or at least I said that it occurs very frequently. Also words like with, or without, or to, etc., they are very frequent usually, while open class words tend to be less frequent. And I've already said that new words tend to come into open classes rather than closed classes. The grammatical, the functional words tend to be stable. I say tend to be because if you look at it over many generations, then things change. The prepositions that we have nowadays did not exist, some of them, let's say, 500 years ago. Just to illustrate this, as a little aside, what word class does absent belong to? He was absent, you know?
The open class,
namely adjectives, okay? Yeah. Have a look at this. Is this an adjective? If you look at what it occurs with, where it is, where it stands in the sentence, then this doesn't really look like an adjective anymore. This is more like a preposition. Now, absent is a word which is currently, over the past few years, maybe 10 years or so, becoming more and more frequently used as a preposition. It started off in the legal domain. This is from a legal text. I've now found it in a linguistics textbook, etc. And maybe in 20, 30 years' time, absent will be a normal preposition. So these things do happen, but they're very rare. Okay, I'm going to skip this one slide here. And move straight into morphology. Right, let's have a quick look at this sentence. The lecture greatly expanded their knowledge. Okay. We could talk about how many words. Okay, we've done this. But what I'm now interested in is the internal parts of words. And I'm sure you agree with me that we could, for example, split up greatly into great and lee. Or expand and ed. And I could then ask, what is the meaning of these parts? With the li in great li, we would perhaps find it quite difficult to say what it means, but I think with the ed, we can quite easily see what it means. It means past tense. If it's not there, then expand is not in the past. Okay. So we could say that this lexical element has a meaning, and then we have a second part of the word which has a grammatical meaning. Sometimes we have words that look like as if they had been put together from two parts, but in fact that's not the case. Know and ledge, of course know can stand on its own, but what's the meaning of ledge? Well, there is a word in English, ledge, but that's not what's used here. So, that's not true. Knowledge is simply one unit of meaning. Yeah? We can confirm this by looking at whether there are other words where ledge is found at the end. And then we see that very, very few exist at all, and they're all related to knowledge. Okay. So, we can basically say that ledge is not anything that you can attach to words to express a particular meaning. It's not a suffix. And more importantly, it's not a productive suffix. We can't add it to other words. Okay. That brings me to the definition of morpheme. A morpheme is the smallest meaningful unit of language. If you think back to the definition of phoneme, which is the smallest meaning distinguishing unit of language, then you can see that we are now one level higher up in the description. It cannot be further divided into elements that carry meaning. It can be further divided into phonemes, but they do not carry meaning, they only distinguish between meanings. So, that's the definition of morpheme. So, for example, in a word like untruthful, you could say that we have three parts. We have un, and we have truth, and we have full. And we could name the individual parts. We have a prefix, un. We have a suffix, full. And in fact, both of them can be subsumed under affixes. Okay? Affixes can be either suffixes or prefixes. In fact, they're also infixes and interfixes, but not in English, really. Okay. Good, so we've done this with untruthful. We can also do this with a word like unknowns. Okay. We have the same prefix, un, but we have a different suffix, namely s. In both cases, we have three elements, but they are slightly different. Well, they're not only different because it's different letters or graphemes. Okay. They're different because of the meaning of these elements. Let's look at this in a bit more detail. Again, we have a prefix, we have a suffix, and in fact, the middle, the lexical element, we could call root. Okay. The thing that we cannot divide any further, that can stand on its own. Okay. Some people call it base, some call it stem. The one that you cannot divide further is typically called root. What does this S mean? It means third person singular. Okay. What does this third person singular morpheme do? It creates a new word form of the same lexeme. Okay. Remember that I introduced lexeme just now? Cook and cooks are two different word forms of that same lexeme. Now, if this is the case, if an element that is attached to a word produces a new word form of the same lexeme, then this is a case of inflection. So this is an inflectional morph that I'm adding. Okay? The prefix un means something different. It means opposite. Yeah? Or something like that. Okay. Is this the same in the sense that by attaching this, we create a different word form of the same lexeme? Would we find loads and unloads under the same entry in a very large dictionary? It's, in a way, two different words, isn't it? So, this prefix, therefore, does not create a new word form. It creates, or it derives, a new lexeme from an old one, which in itself might have different word forms again. And a morpheme that does that, a morph that does that, is a derivational morph. This is a fundamental distinction in morphology that you need to be aware of, the difference between inflection and derivation. Okay. And in fact, there's a third one, which is sort of self-explanatory. The root itself is the lexical element, and people usually call it the lexical morph. Now, there are only very few inflectional morphemes in English. English has lost most of them in the Middle Ages, okay, since the Middle Ages. There are only 8 in the language. We're not listing them all now. Okay. Also, another hint. If you add something to a word at the beginning of the word, it must be derivational. There are no derivational, no affixes in the sense of prefixes that are inflectional in the English language. Now, if anyone's paid good attention, they may have noticed that the definition that I gave you was that of a morpheme. Yeah? And here, I've used the word morph. That's because there is a distinction between morph and morpheme, which is very, very similar to the one between phone and phoneme, and between word and lexeme, or word form and lexeme. Okay? And in fact, if we had looked at spelling more, we could also have talked about a grapheme and a graph. Okay? This is something which goes through several different levels of description, as I already said before. And it's the same. It's an abstract concept versus a realization of that concept. And I'd like to illustrate this to you with the most typical example. Let's look at the plural. How can we form the plural in English? This is very, very easy. Well, if we have a word like hat, then the plural is hats. Okay? And we can now use the phonemic transcription system to show this. This is a voiceless consonant. Okay? Hat, hats. There's no vibration going on. Dog, dogs. Well, we're doing this now, but this is a voiced way of marking the plural. I think you see that these are two different realizations. They mean the same thing. They mean plural. There are a few exceptions. Ox. What's the plural of ox? Oxen. Okay. There are a few old exceptions from earlier ways of forming the plural left. So, how is the plural formed here? By adding the suffix -en. Okay. And then we've got the case of sheep. Sheep don't have a plural. Okay. There are more sheep than that. Two sheep, three sheep, but we've got a zero plural. And in a way, this zero, even though it's there, means plural. Yeah? We could almost sort of postulate a zero morph. So, we've got singular words here, we've got plural words, and what we've done is we've attached something. We've attached an inflectional morph. And all of them mean the same thing. They mean plural. This is the morpheme, and these are the morphs. This is the abstract concept, and this is the way the concept is realized. Do you see the connection with phone and phoneme? Okay. And since we introduced allophones, it probably makes sense to you now that I'm introducing these as allomorphs. They are allomorphs because they mean the same thing, but are different. Okay? Right. I think you need some time to exercise this and to get a breather. I've got a sentence here. He reconsidered the proposal and hunted down the left-handed waiter. Okay? I had to come up with a sentence where you can find a few things. I'll be quiet for 2 minutes. Can you find all the morpheme boundaries? Can you tell me whether the morphemes that you identify, or in fact what you see is the morphs, but in the same way as we can talk about phonemes, we can talk about morphemes. Can you tell me whether they are lexical, derivational, or inflectional? And as a bonus question, do you find any allomorphs in the sentence? Okay, 2 minutes. Okay, 2 minutes almost over. I've colored this for you. Okay. So the re, for example, is a derivational, and the ed here is an inflectional. The l in proposal is a derivational morpheme. Okay. Here we have two separate lexical ones. Okay. Did anyone find any allomorphs? So we've got reconsidered and haunted. And what about this ed? Okay. Now, these two are allomorphs. Why? Well, reconsidered, haunted. Okay, they are realized slightly differently. But this is not an allomorph. Why is this not an allomorph? If you've understood this, you've understood the concept. Yes. Yes, so the ed is, the ed itself is not the verb, of course, but it's an inflection that is added to the verb meaning past. This does not mean past tense. It looks the same. It may even sound the same. Yeah? But it's not the same. It doesn't mean the same. Allomorphs only are allomorphs if they mean the same thing as the other allomorphs. Okay? Because the allomorphs are the realizations, the different realizations of the same morpheme, which are therefore different realizations of the same meaning. Okay, yes. Yes. These two EDs are realized differently. They sound differently. Yeah? They are spelled the same, but spelling is not a good indicator for whether something is different or not. We've seen that spelling is an unreliable indicator of how language is actually produced. Yeah? So we've got ud versus id. In the same way as we have cats versus dogs. Okay? Good. You need some light fare now, I think. Okay, I've bombarded you with a few heavy things. There will be more heavy stuff, less heavy than that. This was the heaviest bit of this lecture. Okay? But you'll get a bit of Calvin and Hobbes from me now. Okay. I need help on my homework. What's a pronoun? A noun that has lost its amateur status. Okay? Maybe I can get a point for originality. Now, it's always bad to explain jokes, but we can explain this joke with our knowledge of morphology. Because what does Hobbes do? Well, misinterprets the meaning of the prefix pro. Yeah? Pro as in professional. So, we could in a way say that it's a different morpheme that he's using. Okay, how about this one? This is from Wiley's dictionary. Relief, what the trees do in the spring. Relief. Okay? Obviously, not quite the correct interpretation of the morphological structure. To be relieved has nothing to do with redoing something. Okay? So, quite a few of those jokes rely on a wrong interpretation of the morphological structure. Now, the next one is usually quite funny for me, because a few of you will get it within 3 seconds, And then for the next 30 or so seconds, you'll hear, ah, ah, ah. You're trying to be quiet. Still some more? Okay. Who is the first man? Adam. Okay? Most of you didn't get it yet. Okay. Again, the joke relies on a misinterpretation of morphological structures. So the first and is not Adam, of course. Okay, there are quite a few of those. If you want the larger list of things that are supposed to be funny, some are in fact better than others. Okay. Here is a bad one from that webpage. The definition of copulate. Well, a policeman who misses an appointment. Ha ha ha. Yeah? Well, why is this not so good? It's not so good because it does not conform to the normal word formation rules of English. There is no infix U in English. Okay. So I think this one is not as funny as some of the other things that I've shown you. But we've come to the second question that I want to ask today, and now you need to concentrate again. How do languages increase their vocabulary? Because there are various ways of forming new words, and they have to do with morphology. Okay. Half an hour more. Come on. Maybe not even half an hour. Okay. Right. Now, when you think of increasing vocabulary, then you may think, perhaps, at first, that we're talking about borrowing. Okay. So words like karaoke, or many other words that have been borrowed from other languages as a result of contact. I always like to point out that, of course, borrowing is a bit of a misnomer, because you don't, I mean, when you borrow something, you give it back, but the language doesn't usually give back the words it borrows. But anyway, this is just a silly comment. So this is one way of increasing the vocabulary. Okay. But there are others. We've already seen one, namely derivation. You'll need to know the different ways of word formation. And they're just part of, like you need to know the different ways of describing a sound. You'll need to be able to know and work with the different ways of word formation. Right. So we've got derivation, and in fact we've got prefixes and suffixes, and we can see that, for example, in let's say the last 20 years or so, some new words have been formed with some prefixes that relate nowadays to the internet as an important influence on society. We've got cyberpunk, we've got cyber banking, we've got cyber sex, we've got cyber squatter, and we've got a few other cybers. Okay. We can combine affixes. Maybe you know the words anti-disestablishmentarianism. I always fumble when I have to say this word. You get the point. We can actually stack derivational suffixes. Okay, that was derivation. Another very, very frequent way of forming new words is compounding. What is compounding? Well, combine two lexical elements, two lexical morphemes, and you make a new word. I am now going back to saying morpheme, and I'm no longer just saying morph, okay, because now we've introduced the difference between morph and morpheme, and I can now sort of talk about concepts rather than the realizations. Finnegan doesn't make that distinction, but I felt it was important to make. I'll give you a few examples of compounds, and there can be different types. Skinhead, well, noun. Pickpocket is verb and noun, and nosedive is noun and verb. There are many different combination options. Okay. In English, actually, and increasingly so in German, I observe, you can look at compounds as two separate orthographic words. It used to be, I think, quite impossible in German, but nowadays you do find words spelled apart from each other orthographically, perhaps as an influence, through influence from English. Compounds are really quite fascinating if you look at it in more detail. I just want to mention one or two things. Do you know what a call girl is? Sorry, there's a lot of sex in this lecture. We had, what did we have? Cyber sex, we had copulate. This is non-intentional, okay? Almost. Okay. But it's interesting to look at the meaning of call girl. Okay? Because if you look up in the Oxford Dictionary, Oxford English Dictionary, what a call boy is, then you have many more meanings of call boy. A youth employed in a theatre to attend upon the prompter and call the actors when required on the stage. Okay. This is an interesting case of, well, let's call it sexism or connections between language and gender. Okay. You'll be talking about things like that in the next term when my colleague takes over. Okay. But you can see this in some of those compounds. Compounds can also be interesting in terms of structure. Okay. Do you know what an invisible mending specialist is? Well, it's someone who mends clothes, who fixes clothes in such a way that you can't see things anymore. Can't see that they've been fixed, I guess. Okay. But you could, of course, depending on how you structure this, read this as if the specialist was invisible. Right, so looking at the hierarchy of elements in compounds can be interesting. Anyway, just wanted to mention those two points. We have various ways of shortening words. We have clippings. We can have front clippings, as in phone, which is derived from telephone. We have back quick clippings, as ad, from advertisement. Or in fact, we've got both front and back clipping, as in flu, which is really influenza, but nobody says that. Another clipping, which no one actually realizes nowadays is a clipping, is pram. Do you know what pram? Do you know what a pram is? Anyone with babies here? Okay, pram is a kindergarten. Okay, what does it come from? It's a perambulator. Okay, so it's been clipped. Okay. All right, another way of shortening things is through acronyms or as acronyms, things like NATO and NASA or NASA. Actually, don't know. Anyway, laser. Okay. Laser we use as if it was a word. NASA. NASA, yes. Okay. Anyway. but in fact, it is an abbreviation. Okay. And that's exactly the point. The acronyms are pronounced as if they were a word. While the initialisms, like ASAP, as soon as possible, or BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, are produced as if it was individual letters. Okay. Another way of shortening things is through blending. This is actually a very recent word formation process. It is actually said to have been invented by Carol Lewis, but I'm not sure whether that's actually true. Where you take two words and blend them together, as in smog, which is smoke, and fog, or infomercial, or guesstimate. Okay, that was shortening. Here is another one to make how to make new words. Conversion. Conversion is something like derivation, just that you don't see anything that is used to derive a new word, a new lexeme. So, for example, you can make a noun out of a verb, or vice versa. You can talk about bottling up something, or you can bridge thoughts, or something else. Or you can better something. Or you can dirty something, which is not the same as the adjective. As I said, it can also go the other way around. A call or a guess is a deverbal noun. The point here is the word form is exactly the same. The word class is different. So that's why it's called zero derivation.
How do you know whether it was first noun or verb?
Usually the more recent one is the less frequent one, but not even that one may be true. You go and look it up in a good dictionary. Yeah. I mean, here we know. This is a t-shirt you can buy. Okay. Here we know which is first. Okay. But sometimes I can see if both are very frequent, maybe you don't know. Okay. And the word formation process that many people think is quite frequent is actually very, very infrequent. Invention hardly comes in as a mechanism. We have nylon, nerd, and blurb. A blurb, do you know what a blurb is? A blurb is when you turn around a book and you see sort of well, this book is about this, and it's brilliant, and it shows you that, etc. This is called a blurb. So this is a very rare phenomenon. I'm not quite over yet. There is something which students usually find difficult to understand. That's called back formation. Okay. And it raises a little bit the point that you've just mentioned. How do we know which is first? Well, sometimes you may actually misinterpret things. Now, with zero derivation or conversion, you see no difference. But we have also cases like edit and editor, where it looks as if this was the older one and this is the younger one. No, sorry. Yes. I get confused as well. Okay. So first we had edit, and then, based on the normal productive process, we get editor. Same with beg. Or extrapolate. But in fact, it's the other way around. This is the older one, and this was then formed on the wrong assumption that we are actually dealing with a derivation process. Okay. In fact, there is a word, which became pea in English, as in the little green thing to eat, which actually is a case of back formation, where this looked as if it was plural, okay, when it wasn't. Although plural is, of course, inflectional. But anyway, it's the same principle. So here's a definition. By back formation, I'm referring to the deletion of a wrongly identified suffix in a lexeme by analogy with other instances where the suffixed and non-suffixed forms are both lexemes. Okay. What does it mean? Well, it sounds more complex than it is. It just is a wrong interpretation of the morphological structure. Okay. This doesn't happen very often, but it happens. A final one I wanted to mention, I think it's final, is helter skelter or nitty gritty, something very rare in English, reduplication, where an element is repeated. Okay. This doesn't really happen as a productive process. Hello, you up there, can you please? Thank you. It is not, yeah, I can hear it till down here. Okay, and I'm sure the people sitting in front of you can hear you even much more, and they probably get disturbed by you. Okay, and that's what I'm worried about. I'm not worried about me. Right, okay. Just a traditional rant that I have to do once a lecture, right, it seems. Anyway, okay. In other languages, this is much more common. If anyone speaks Indonesian, then they may know hati means danger, hati-hati means watch out, or very dangerous. Where the reduplication actually means more, okay, it's one way of forming the plural, or more in the sense of emphasis. Okay. As I said, compounding is very important, and this is confirmed here. No, you do not need to know percentages by heart. Okay? You need to know that compounding is important. And you maybe need to know that things like blending or whatever are less important ones. But please don't go and learn percentages by heart. Okay? In fact, if you go back in the history of English, then borrowing was at some stage much more important after the Norman conquest, for example. Okay. So this is just something for present English. Okay, I'd like to finish the lecture with a few slides. Not finished yet, so I have quite a few slides. Okay. It's still 15 minutes to go. By looking at variation in the lexicon. Variation is something that you'll be doing a lot next semester. But I'd like to introduce a few concepts. First of all, I'm sure you've heard of dialects. And many people will have the definition of dialect as something that is a subordinate variety of language, a low variety of language. Dialects are not as good as standard varieties. Okay? Well, you can scratch that. Everyone speaks a dialect. You may just be speaking the standard dialect. Okay? In fact, there is a nice expression that a language, or a nice saying, that a language is a dialect with an army and a navy. Okay? What's meant by this? Well, a language is a dialect with dictionaries, with things that defend, or with people that defend it. So there's codification of it, and there are books about it, etc. But really, from a linguistic point of view, it's the same. Okay. And we can look at regional and social dialects. Okay, there was a survey done on variation, and I don't want to go into any detail, but this was really quite interesting when I was still teaching in England, because I had, 200 people from all over the country. And I could ask them, do you lay or set the table? And I asked, who lays the table? And then some people put their hands up, and others set the table. And you can nicely actually plot this in a dictionary atlas. Okay. Down here you lay, up here you set, with some sort of enclaves where you do the other thing. When you're about to faint, do you feel dizzy, giddy, or even mazy? I taught somewhere up here in Lancaster, so quite a few people felt mazy, but they're in a minority if you look at the whole country. Here down there, they feel giddy, and here they feel dizzy. Okay. Actually, here they feel swiney. Didn't know that before. Okay. When you sweep the floor, do you use a brush or a broom? Again, that's a dialectal. There is dialectal variation. Interestingly, you use a brush down here and up here. Okay, but in the middle, you use a broom. Okay. So this is an element, or this is one of the ways we can look at regional dialects. by looking at the vocabulary used. We can also look at social dialects, for example, age and gender, but also social status, socioeconomic status. Okay. Remember that we quickly looked at how the word lovely is used in lecture one, and we looked at elderly women being very frequent lovely users. And we can see how the lexicon can vary over time, over different dialects there too. Right, that was dialect. I want to introduce another concept, and that's register. The regional dialect says where we come from. If I open my mouth, perhaps not so much, because I don't speak a strong local dialect, but if someone from, I don't know, the Eifel, who does not speak standard, German dialect, but let's say speaks to a friend, then it's very clear where they come from, simply by the way they pronounce things. Social dialects, we might also, particularly in England, see about social differences by the way language is used. In register, this is not about where we come from, but what we're doing. So this is about uses rather than users. So things like speech situation, setting, purpose, participants. I am talking to you in a slightly different way than I would talk to my wife, even though I use English in both contexts. Okay. For example, if we meet in a pub, if we, I don't know, go to Stammtisch together or whatever, and then I'll say, cheers, mate. Probably wouldn't use cheers, mate, to you, but that might be something that I could do, let's say, if I go to England. This will sort of set the tone, or it will give you some information about who we are, what we're doing with language. Okay, this is informal, for example. Thank you very much indeed. Okay? This is obviously very much more formal. So, levels of formality are questions of register. In fact, we could have technical registers as well, and then we're talking about jargon. Okay. For example, yes?
Lingo.
Sorry?
Lingo,
yeah, jargon, there are different ways of talking about that, yeah. For example, if I say... if I give you the example of HIV positive, okay, positive is positive because something is there that other people don't have. But we have different associations with positive or negative because we are not professional doctors, okay? Or a nose job, okay, if you have your nose fixed, rhinoplasty, okay? That's what the doctor would say. Okay, quite clearly a different register. And it gets louder and louder. People want to leave. Okay. I have a few slides left. The concept of slang. We have no time to go in. No, come on, please. Just a few more minutes. We don't have any time to talk about slang now, but you can see how this comes into looking at different registers. This is about in-group communication, etc. Again, something that you will look at in much more detail next term. It's also something that is typically quite short-lived. There are some slang expressions in English that have been around for hundreds of years, like bread for money, but others are typically very short-lived and stigmatized in the sense of that people don't like it. Okay. Final things I would like to say refer to ways of looking at register. Okay. Ways of finding out differences. For example, we could find out what the most frequent words are in each register. And I have a comparison here of pop songs, academic papers, spoken and written English. Now, if you look at these lists, these are the most frequent lists, the words in a collection of such texts, then you can see that there isn't that much of a difference, actually. Or in a way, well, I mean, the is down here and the is up here, but the appears in both lists. Okay. The only real difference here is language. Okay. These were linguistics papers. But this is because what we've included here is all words, open class and closed class. If we just look at open class items, then we can see things are very different. With pop songs, we have things like love, okay, and make, possibly even make love, or we have sex again, okay, sorry. Life, boyfriend, baby, I don't know whether that's related to, no, probably not. Anyway, sad, bring, etc. While in academic texts, very frequent nouns will be linguistics, well, not in all academic texts, of course, it depends on your selection. Okay. So in other words, we can see the difference between registers by looking at the vocabulary, and whether there are, if you look at the kind of words, these are much longer words, right? They're longer, partly because they're foreign and borrowed, but they're also longer possibly because they are put together on the basis of word formation process. Historical is, we have a derivational process that was a thing, that happened. While here, we have many more monosyllabic words. We could compare spoken and written language, and we will do so later on in the course. What's described here? A rainbow. Normally after very heavy rain or something like that, and you're driving along the road, and far away you see, well, a series of stripes, etc. If you counted the number of different words, you would find a lower number than here. This is also about the rainbow, but it's a written text. And in fact, it's a text by D.H. Lawrence. Okay? And you would see much more variability, much more variance, much more lexical density, actually, is the word. Okay? But, and that allows me to lead over to the next lecture, this is not only about the vocabulary. This is about syntax and grammar, and that's what we're going to start next week. And that is my favorite topic. And you'll get four long lectures on syntax, on grammar, on the structure of words, of sentences, etc. Okay. And that will be important. Okay? So.